From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, one of the hardest challenges facing refugees today is validating their identity, how the technology behind Bitcoin could help.
The technology that Bitcoin leverages is called blockchain. It's a decentralized distributed ledger. It empowers people to have a secure means to collect data and build a credit history.
Then an exhibit at the Milwaukee Public Museum explores the ancient Mayan civilization of Central America. They had a pretty sophisticated understanding of astronomy, even if they didn't exactly use it to further scientific knowledge.
Their goal was to explain their own mythology of how the world was created and why, and so they saw it all as tied up with religion.
We'll meet a Milwaukee man who has turned decluttering into a million-dollar business.
And we'll have the latest edition of our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next, after the news.
Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. The refugee crisis is still a huge problem. It affects the developing world as people leave war-torn or famine-stricken countries and resettle in refugee camps, often in other developing nations. And it affects countries like the United States or Western European nations as refugees seek to build new lives in places with economic opportunities.
But those economic opportunities are not always accessible to refugees, sometimes because of immigration policies, but often because they have no way to validate their history or their identity. A former refugee now living in Minnesota is working to change that. Hamsi Warfa is Executive Vice President of Business Development for BankQ, an app that uses the technological backbone of Bitcoin to help refugees reclaim their identity. He was in Milwaukee recently and joined us in the studio. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Can you lay out the fundamental problem that BankQ addresses or seeks to address?
Yes. There's 2.5 billion people around the world who don't have any means of showing who they are, proving who they are. So lack of verifiable identity is a huge global and local challenge facing our communities. Coupled with the refugee crisis, there are 65 million people who are refugees and displaced around the world. And many of them are moving from one place to another. And as a former refugee myself, I have a firsthand experience of what it means to lose your identity and your history that does not carry with you as you move from point A to point B.
Well, and so paint a picture of that for us. You know, people have a general knowledge in this country of things like identity theft, but what does it mean to not have a verifiable identity, and how does it affect what you're able to do and become?
Yeah, as a way of context, so I was born in Somalia. First 10 years of my life I spent in Mogadishu, peaceful Mogadishu before the war. But when the war happened, my family had to flee, and we came to a refugee camp known as the Dadaab refugee camp, a camp that was built for 70,000 people but became home for 600,000 people with facilities that was meant for 70,000 people. When my parents, who were very successful business, you know, entrepreneurs, came to Kenya, they lost who they were. So despite the fact that they had a long career, you know, successful business, they became nobodies. So we had a statistical number that we would use to collect food and water. So all the work that has been done was completely lost. And so what it meant for us is that as we moved from one camp to another, we had to repeat immunization, for example. We had to, despite the fact that some refugees have a high entrepreneurial spirit, they get services from NGOs, they repay back loans they get. So they have a record because life is about collection of activities and events. It's like starting your life all over again every time when you don't have an identity. So it has a huge implication on whether you stay in poverty or not, and whether you have access to the global economy or not.
And the thing that really struck me as I was getting ready for this interview is that the average stay in a refugee camp is 17 years. Is that right?
That's correct. That's correct.
That's a huge block of time that if you can't develop your own identity or collect the experiences to have that void in your life.
Yeah, I freshly remember a young person I met in the Dadaab refugee camp just last year. And he shared with me that his parents had 20 loans from, the likes of like Danish Refugee Council, where they have successfully repaid back. But now many of them are being repatriated back to Somalia. So everything they have done in the camp, the education they have received, the loans they have repaid back, all of that do not become part of their record. So when they go back, when they are repatriated, it's like starting all over again. So, and then if they are resettling in the United States, in Milwaukee and Minneapolis and places like that, the first challenge that refugee experiences is that you're not even allowed to get a rental apartment because you need a history. And if you don't have a history, someone has to co-sign for you. And what happens is that resettlement agencies sometimes, are able to co-sign for you to even rent. But there are instances where you might not even find anybody to do that for you. Imagine if you had came with your record where you can say, hey, look, I had 10,000 loans from Danish Refugee Council. UNHCR have given me this and I've, repaid this amount of loan. I had a small shop in the camp. And guess what? I had education from so-and-so, and so I have a certificate. Yeah, it completely transforms your life. So you come with credit history as you rebuild your life and start, new life in a new country, a new land.
So you mentioned loans, for example, from NGOs and other aid agencies. Have there ever been other attempts to help refugees establish these issues of identity in the past?
There hasn't been any successful attempt, that has taken place yet. But because of new technology, most people know Bitcoin. But the technology that Bitcoin leverages is called blockchain. And blockchain is a decentralized distributed ledger. It empowers people to have a secure means to collect data and build a credit history without corporate control, without centralized database. Because right now, most of our data is corporate control. Even in the United States, my health record sits with, health clinic this, health clinic that. My education certificate is with San Diego State University, Springfield College, and so forth. Imagine a scenario where all of my data points are triangulated and I don't have to go through a centralized mechanism to get access. I own it. It's my own data. And I give permission to the networks, organizations, companies, banks that are providing services to me. And that's a huge transformative innovation that have just started, because of blockchain technology.
Who then is in a position to validate that this information that you are supplying to BankU is legitimate?
Yeah, so there's some multiple data points, some that don't even belong to the individual that uses. So just quickly, you develop your identity by through selfie, taking selfie. And you can attach multiple other data points. You can also connect with existing systems. With blockchain, there is no servers. There is, it's not really even a database. It's a decentralized distributed ledger. The best example I use is, the fax machine. So the first fax machine was useless because you needed a second fax machine in order for it to work. So you need to start with two fax machines, and then you start building the network that validates, who you are. And just like in Facebook and LinkedIn, when you want to reset your password, they use data points that don't belong to you. For example, they will align 5 pictures of your friends, one of your friends and 4 others that you don't know, and they say, pick who do you know from here to verify your identity. So the verification happens in multiple ways. One way is that if you are working with NGOs and there's literacy issues and things like that, that NGO becomes your intermediary, the validator. And our system allow, our platform allows us to connect with universities where you got your degree. So there is a way to request verification from institutions that provided the services to you.
Well, and so again, give us a paint a picture. If this technology had been available while you were going through your own refugee experience, you and your family were, how would it have made a difference?
It would have uplifted us from poverty very quickly because life is about collection of activities and events. If we came and showed that my father had a successful livestock business and my mother had a very successful retail clothing business, that we were able to have our own small shop, we had transactions and activities happening, that would have, we would have been credit worthy. We would have been someone who is credible, you know. And it's like getting a mortgage, you know, you need your credit history in order to get a loan. For women farmers around the world, you know, some who the coffee that we enjoy here is made by women somewhere in the world. But unfortunately, she does not get credit for the work that she has done. And it has a huge implication. Where our name came from, BankU, is that we, when we saw this interesting gap in poverty, how we approach poverty, was that in the Congo, South Kivu, my co-founder and our CEO was in the in South Kivu, and he came with a woman who made $200 from her business harvest. And she came to a bank and wanted to open an account. The teller said, "You are not. I cannot bank you, number one, because you're women, and number two, it was very cost prohibitive." But the teller told my co-founder, "I can bank you because you have history." So my colleague turned around and told the women, "One day we'll bank you." So that's where our name comes from. So this has a huge, you know, upliftment, empowerment, and really dignity. It provides an opportunity for someone to feel dignified. They own their own data. They have a means to connect to the global economy. They can monetize the relationships they have with family members who might live in the West, who provide remittance money and, you know, things like that. So it moves someone from being dependent to independence, and someone to have an integrated set of records they can monetize. They can get tractor loan and things like that. You know, so for a woman, they, you know, they have a 40% interest, for example, to get a tractor loan, as opposed to, say, men who get 10%. In part, it's because she doesn't have a way to build her credit history.
You mentioned one of the means of validation is taking a selfie. And I was surprised to learn that smartphones are have proliferated as much as they have, even inside refugee camps.
Yeah. Interestingly, when I so I went back to the same tent that I have lived before I came to the United States, 20 years ago. And what I saw in the Dadaab refugee camp, you know, in 2016 and 2017 was that, so there is no electricity, but yet 40 to 60% cell phone usage. And I asked, how do you charge your phones? People use solar lights to charge their phones. And one interesting experience we had in Zaatari camp in Jordan for Syrian refugees was that even the UNHCR and the systems did not know that the refugees created their own Facebook groups and they were selling products and services online, and they were monetizing those relationships, you know. And so what is empowering is that, you know, the technological advancement, the cell phone penetration is there. And as we move from, you know, the Internet of Things to social media to now monetizing the relationships that you have, it's a perfect timing for a blockchain solution to uplift people from poverty. So we Most people, as I said, associate blockchain with Bitcoin, but we don't do mining. We decouple the mining aspect of it, and we're using the core blockchain technology in a private permission network to make sure that people are able to feel secure as they use, you know. So it's much more secure than, you know, the Gmail, the Facebooks, you know, the things that we already use.
Well, and the your motto is dignity through identity.
Yes, we believe that, you know, the most important thing that human being needs is dignity. And through dignity is where what we're calling economic identity or economic passport, is where someone has a global economic identity that connects them to opportunities. So we want to focus on, you know, reducing the opportunity gap.
Well, it is a powerful concept. Hamza Warfa, thank you so much for taking some time to tell us about it, and really best of luck in your work.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Mitch.
Hamza Warfa is one of the founders and the executive vice president of BankQ, a Minnesota-based company that helps refugees validate their identity. Since its founding around 5 years ago, BankQ is in use with more than 25,000 people on four continents. You can find more information about it at wuwm.com.
Coming up after a break, the world of the ancient Maya comes to life at the Milwaukee Public Museum. We'll visit the new exhibit when Lake Effect Weekend returns on Milwaukee's NPR.
It's Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. The largest exhibition on the ancient Maya ever to be displayed in the United States is currently on view at the Milwaukee Public Museum. This pre-Columbian civilization flourished in what is now Central America and had advanced mathematics, a written language, and sophisticated art and architecture.
But Carter Lupton, the former curator of ancient history at the Public Museum, says the question this exhibit hopes to answer is not only who were the Maya, but who are they? Because they're still around.
The Maya make up one of the largest groups of native-speaking pre-Columbian American Indians that are still extant. There are several million of them living in the Maya area, which includes the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico, all of Guatemala, all of Belize, and portions of Honduras and El Salvador. So it's a fairly large area. The Maya are, as a people, are defined as people who speak a Mayan language, which there are many, many different dialects of Mayan languages. They are part of a larger cultural group called Mesoamericans, which includes Aztecs, Toltecs, Olmecs, groups that are not Maya, but share similar cultural patterns with the Maya. They share things like the same food crops, maize, beans, squash, and chili peppers. They share building monumental architecture and building pyramids as their main temple structures. They share ideas like the ball game, the famous Maya ball game. It's not just the Maya ball game, it's the Mesoamerican ball game. So you'll find that up even in central Mexico, out of the Maya area. So they're just part of this bigger cultural pattern.
You've talked about what is similar that the Maya have in common with these other groups. What makes them distinct?
Well, as I said, what defines them officially is their language. If they speak a Mayan language, of which, as I said, there are many, many dialects, then they are Maya people. Other things that make them different just by chance, for example, archaeologically, is the fact that the Maya actually have a complete written language, which we could not 30 years ago really translate very much of. Now we can translate most of it. So that's one of the big changes that's happened in the last 20, 30 years. If you look at Aztecs, for example, in central Mexico, they have written or pictographic documents, which we call Aztec writing, but it's not really writing. They're not writing verbs and vowels and full sentences and full grammar. They are putting down pictures of things to say, well, we got so much tribute of deer skins, we got so much tribute to this, so they put that with a number by it. That's picture writing, and it's a very simple form of not truly full writing. The Maya have a very fascinating advanced grammar that uses both phonetic and ideographic or meaningful sounds, symbols. So that's one of the big differences, and that's why we've learned so much more about the Maya. We're used to the Aztecs because the Aztecs were here when the Spanish came. I mean, the Maya were here too, but the Maya were no longer living in these complex cities that we see in this exhibit because most of those had been abandoned. But the Maya as a people still existed. The Aztecs were the big power in Mexico at the time, and so that's who the Spanish went out of their way to conquer. Deal with and conquer, yes. And so we hear a lot about the Aztecs. There are a lot of contemporary reports by Spaniards, whereas there are far fewer contemporary reports about what the Maya were like, who they sort of saw as, I guess, backwater people, you know, just living on the fringes of real civilization.
Do we know what happened, why the Maya abandoned their cities, and why the complex civilization seemed to simplify?
Well, there's no one single reason, as with so many things, whether it's the demise of the dinosaurs or anything else. There's never one explanation. Several have been proposed over the years, and we're in a period now where generally they look at individual sites and say, what happened at this site? And in some sites, it's collapse of the environment over exploitation, deforestation, erosion, and then, of course, loss of crops. Loss of crops means loss of population, loss of power for the political rulers, can lead to revolts. And when the political rulers are gone, there's nobody to control building massive monuments anymore. So people may stick around as squatters in a site and live in buildings that are already built, but they're not going to be building new ones. Or they may abandon them altogether for greener pastures. So it's a lot of different features and different, there are droughts, of course. So there's natural factors that they can't control and other things that you could call societal problems.
One of the things that I think the Maya are known for now is that they had very complex mathematics, and they also were very good and keen astronomers, were they not?
To a certain degree. I mean, they did very tight observations astronomically. Most of it was not for its own sake. Their goal was not to understand the universe and how it worked. Their goal was to explain their own mythology of how the world was created and why. And so they saw it all as tied up with religion, which most ancient cultures, you couldn't separate science and religion the way we do today. They would see it as some combination of the two. They certainly followed movements of the sun and moon. They also, the Maya, very carefully could calculate and had calculated the movements of Venus, the planet Venus. Not a whole lot else, but they were good mathematicians, as you say. The Maya actually invented, and I don't even know if it's the Maya, the actual numerical system used by the Maya may have been created by one of the other Mesoamerican peoples, like the Olmecs, we think.
And they sort of appropriated
it. And the Mayas adapted it and borrowed it. But they had, for example, the concept of zero, which had been created in the Arabic numeral system, and I believe one other, but is not a common concept. And without zero, there's not a lot you can do with math, because it's like people ask me all the time, what's the year zero? And I say, there's no year zero. There's a year negative one and there's a year positive one. Year zero wouldn't be a year. It'd be a point in time. So you need a concept of zero as a placeholder between positive numerals and negative numerals.
One of the other things that I think is so interesting about, well, the Maya, but also all of the Mesoamerica peoples, is the kinds of carvings that they did. And it's not just building the temples and those famous tall stairs, you know, they're really hard to go up. But there's these really interesting, very, very detailed, they remind me in some ways of Pictish carvings, like I've seen in Scotland. I mean, that kind of detail. Are these religious? Were they religious figures, or were they notating who the famous people were? Or?
Most of it is historical now. We used to, 30, 40 years ago, they used to say, oh, the Maya are ruled by priest kings, whatever that meant, which was archaeologists' way of saying we don't really know. So they would call them priest kings. Now we know that the carved stela at these various sites, whether it's Copan or Tikal or whatever it happens to be, they depict real individuals, historical people who were their rulers, sometimes the queens of their rulers. It tells their history. It'll give dates of when they were born sometimes, when they became the ruler of that site, what famous battles they may have fought with other sites, whether they won or lost, if they had a child and the child became a king later. All that kind of historical information can now be pulled out of these monuments, which, as they couldn't have been done 3 or 4 decades ago.
For people who are coming into this and might not know much or anything about the Maya civilization or the greater Mesoamerica civilizations. How do you suggest they approach an exhibit like this? What should they be looking for? What should they make sure that they pay attention to?
Well, what's great about this particular exhibit, it is very broad, and it covers almost all major aspects of Maya culture. So it starts out with an introduction about who are the Maya and what do we know about them archaeologically, how we learned about them. There's a whole timeline here that talks about the years that the various discoveries were made. And if you're into that, you can get a history of that fairly quickly. But then it goes into Maya culture itself, and it talks about individual sites. It talks about their accomplishments, whether it's architectural. We have several large-scale replicas, which are impossible to miss. They're the sort of standouts visually of the exhibit.
And these are the stela you were talking about that have the figures.
Various kings, yeah. Yes. For example, there are two here standing side by side, two stela. And 30 years ago or more, I would say, if you looked in a book, they would not know who these individuals were. They'd say that these are both Maya rulers. This one's from a site in Copan in Honduras, and the next one next to it is actually from a site in Guatemala, but it's very close by, the site of Quirigua. But we know today that the king from Honduras is depicted on a stela, and he was a very famous and long-lived king at Copan. The stela next to him, which is actually bigger, is from a smaller site. Quirigua is a much smaller site, but we know that the king from Quirigua is the man who defeated and killed the king of Copan and beheaded him, something we didn't know 30, 40 years ago. So we can put a history to these just like you can to ancient Egypt, for example, which you couldn't do for the Maya back in the mid-20th century.
It must be exciting for someone like you who spent a lifetime trying to learn about these cultures to have that ability now. It's like keys are unlocking things all over the place.
It is. It's a total change in how you look at it. You know, when I was young, I studied Egypt, and Egypt was a culture we knew a lot about because we could read the hieroglyphs. We've been able to read those since the middle of the 19th century. Whereas the Maya were more of a, you knew the culture in general, you knew what they built, but you didn't know much about them as a people. So it was more of an anthropological look you could have, but you couldn't have a historical look. Now you can look at them historically almost in the same detail. You can look at an ancient Egypt or an ancient Greece.
You say there are still people who are Maya, who are living today, even though obviously these civilizations are long gone. Do those people, do you know, have any connection to these sites? Do they honor their heritage in any way?
Yeah, some do. For example, we have, it's not in this exhibit, but in our permanent exhibit up on the third floor, one small group of Maya called the Lacandon. They live very near ancient Maya city named Palenque in Mexico. Today, if you go to visit Palenque, there's always several Maya, Lacandon Maya, around selling things to tourists that they make. And just still living in that general area and following some of the traditions. Many of the Maya in Guatemala in the south, where it's very mountainous and every village is separated from another village by a little mountain valley, live their own style. Some follow old traditions, many of which are discussed here in the exhibit. They make textiles in patterns that are reminiscent of the ancient patterns that we can see from the carvings. They live basically on the same kinds of basic foods.
How much did the Spanish influence the Maya? You say they're pretty much gone as a big major civilization by the time the Spanish arrived.
Yeah.
Did the Spanish, European, and Catholicism have any real effect on the Maya the way they did on the Aztec?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Catholicism is still the nominal religion of most Maya. You know, they'll say they're Catholic, and then they have churches in their villages, and they go to Catholic Mass and that. But as I say, they still also perform some of their rituals, whether it's rituals to ask for the rain to come and grow the corn, things like that. But they're always somewhat of a blending. You know, they'll take, for example, in Catholic practice, there is some parts of the world where incense is still burned in the church. Well, burning incense is a very typical Maya thing. So to them, it's not adapting it so much. It's just taking something they already do and seeing it in a little different context than it was before.
Carter Lupton is the Curator Emeritus of Ancient History at the Milwaukee Public Museum. The museum's current visiting exhibit, Maya Hidden Worlds Revealed, was created by the Science Museum of Minnesota, the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, and the Museum of Science in Boston.
It's at the Public Museum through the end of May. There is a lot more information about it at WUWM.com.
Up next, we'll meet an entrepreneur who's bringing in a big haul in Milwaukee. We'll learn more when Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
We're back with more of Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Many events can cause us to decide to downsize. The urge to purge might be because we just can't find anything in the house anymore, or maybe the garage is so full of stored stuff we have to park the car outside.
Well, an entrepreneur based northwest of Milwaukee has turned decluttering into a million-dollar business. But WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz learned there's a lot more to the hauling business than financial success.
Eileen Wines commands J-Dog Junk Removal and Hauling Headquarters in Butler, 12 miles northwest of Milwaukee, with authority.
This is our catch-all room. The truck's back up right here.
Eileen picks her way through mounds of hula hoops, exercise equipment, and furniture.
This whole pile is the Goodwill pile.
J-Dog donates some of the stuff its crews remove. Some can be sold and repurposed. The business has just moved into this 28,000-square-foot building, which, under a previous owner, housed dozens of huge oil tanks.
This is filled with sludge. So every tank before it left here was, I mean, it was like a foot deep in here of sludge. They cleaned it out, and then they power wash it.
Eileen says some developers wouldn't touch the place, but she and her husband, who've run a home improvement business for 25 years, see its potential.
And we see the vision. Like, I know by the end of June, this place will be rocking.
While Eileen plays a key role in day-to-day operations, her son Andrew Wines actually owns J-Dog.
This business allows me to take care of the environment.
The original J-Dog came to life 7 years ago in Philadelphia. A military veteran created the business model and now awards franchises to fellow veterans and their families. Andrew fits the criteria, having served both in Iraq and Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
We push the fact that we're veteran-owned and operated because from a marketing standpoint, it's a competitive advantage, right? We're the only company like that. However, I'm here for environmental responsibility. That's my goal and my mission in life. Just so happens, J-Dog allows me to get into it.
But if you think Andrew's sole motivation is environmental, you're about to learn otherwise.
I've been an unemployed vet twice. I came back from 2 deployments without a job. I've been a homeless vet. I've been there, working for small businesses that didn't give me an opportunity, or they didn't like the way I did business, or I wasn't there long enough.
19 months ago, after 3 failed business attempts, Andrew launched a bare-bone J-Dog from his kitchen table.
1 truck, 1 trailer, 1 part-time employee. Now, in total, we have 10 trucks, 13 trailers, 20 employees across 3 states.
And he's planning ahead.
5-year mark, our goal is to have a crew of between 180 and 220 with a 50% veteran retention rate. So I want to hire 100 veterans across the Midwest and Southern California.
Andrew explains what he's looking for in employees.
There's 2 groups of people that we always hire, veterans and felons, guys and girls that need and want and desire a second chance. The only skills that you need to work for us is a good attitude and a willingness to learn.
The things that haven't been sorted.
Not every J-Dog employee falls under the mantle of felons and veterans. Jerome Holmes temped on a big J-Dog job and was hired on the spot for his metal scrapping expertise.
Just so happened, I found these guys and they gave me the opportunity of my life. So here I am.
Jerome's skills are invaluable to J-Dog, but Andrew Wines knows his employee wants more.
When we sat down with Jerome on his 90-day review, he said, I want to learn more. I want to take on a truck. I want to do these things. So we trained him to do more.
Any meeting I go to now, right when I walk in, it was like, oh, J-Dog's here.
Robert Morris is a veteran. He served in West Germany during the Cold War era. At J-Dog's daily 7 a.m. staff meeting, Robert stands out, pant legs tucked neatly in his boots, jacket impeccably clean. His colleagues call him G.I. Joe, but Robert says when he left the service and after, he floundered.
Not being able to deal with things that I'd seen or done, not knowing how to deal with those things, there didn't seem to be a way to climb up.
A relative told him about J-Dog. Robert immediately reached out and now thinks back to his first conversation with owner Andrew Wines.
Talked to me on the phone and said, I'm going to ask you 3 questions. What do you like? What do you want to do? And what don't you like? And I said, I like the idea of belonging to a company like this. I like what you stand for.
Robert says at age 52, he wasn't keen about lifting and hauling heavy materials the rest of his career. What he likes is sales.
I like talking to the people. I like promoting. I like being, you know, out there for the company. He's like, well, that's my job. Do you think you can do my job? And I thought, well, I have nothing to lose at this point. So I said, yeah, I'll do your job.
Owner Andrew Wine says the success bubbling around him is easier to explain than you might think.
We communicate effectively. And we're kind. That's it.
And Andrew adds with a smile, his mom, Eileen, keeps him in line. For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Betts.
Susan's story first aired in January. You can see pictures from it at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break, and then our storytelling series, X-Fabula, comes your way. It is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to X-Fabula!
True personal story.
X-Fabula!
X-Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And it is X-Fabula Radio Time, part of Lake Effect Weekend on WUWM. I'm Bruce Winter. Leah Delaney, co-founder of Milwaukee's X-Fabula, is here after a week off due to not feeling well. Good to see you are healthy and well once again.
Yes, yes. I feel so lucky to be healthy. Isn't that funny? It's not like, you know, this is the first time any of us have been sick, but once we do regain complete like eight cylinders, we're all healthy. It's like we feel so lucky to be here.
Yeah, sometimes you wake up in the morning and you take it for granted, but yes, when you're sick, you go, oh, I wish I was well.
I know, but yes, I do feel lucky.
Yeah.
And guess what? Milwaukee, you might want to feel a little lucky this month, because this month, X-Fabula is going to bring you not one, but two story slams in March. Kind of cray cray.
Yeah.
So the first one is going to happen this week, Wednesday, March 7th, and the theme is karma. Mm-hmm. And it's going to happen at Sugar Maple, and I'm really excited for a whole bunch of reasons. It's a love this venue. I love Adrian, the owner, and I love beer, and I love the fact I'm going to be back up on stage emceeing the show, so it'll be a lot of fun.
Yes, you are a star of radio, screen, and stage, so.
Well, you know, I don't know, star, but yeah. You know.
Well, we do have a couple of stories,
yes,
today on the theme of karma, right?
Yep, we sure do. Let's start out today's show with our friend and fellow from 2015. Here's Nakia Hood with his story from a Whiteness and Privilege event from our fellowship series.
I've always loved education, but I remember at a young age just being crushed for my love of education and having it zapped out of me, so to speak. It all started back in second grade. I remember the summer after finishing second grade, and we were out, it was me, my two sisters, my cousins, we were out playing in the yard, and the mailman came with our report cards. So my aunt came, she had the mail, she started reading off the report cards, promoted to this grade, she would say, in the way only Aunt Lucy can, and she was just celebrating everybody's accomplishments. But then it came to me, and I was just waiting for my pat on the back just like everyone else. And then she opened the report card, and it said demoted. I'm like, man, I didn't even know what demoted meant, but I realized it very soon. So when I started back in second grade again, what came along with second grade was being put in what is known as special education, but at the time they just called it LD, learning disability. How demeaning, right? Because to this day, I still feel like I don't have a learning disability. And also what came with that, from second grade to seventh grade, you had to go to summer school in order to pass, which didn't really make sense to me. I'm in school, I'm doing the work, but I gotta go to summer school? But a miracle, I like to call it, happened in seventh grade. Teacher got pregnant. I guess that is a miracle. But the other miracle was we got a substitute teacher. And I noticed she would always stare at me and see me doing my work. Because here's how LD went in seventh grade. You get a packet of work on Monday, and you have to have it finished by Friday. So I'm thinking, let me finish this real simple work so I can sit in the back of the class, eat snacks, you know, watch TV, do my LD thing. I got used to it. But they pulled me out of class with the substitute teacher, and they made me take a test. And what normally happens, if you pass on this test, you get to go to regular class. Well, I guess I scored decent enough. They pulled me out. I was in regular class the next week. Looking back, LD, well, people don't like for me to call it that because it's special ed now, but I still feel LD. Looking back, I always wondered, why did they take me out of class? Oh, thank you. Why did they take me out of class? Looking back, I realized things such as white privilege, institutional racism, my favorite, soft bigotry. What is that? And that's kind of what happened to me, because also in those classes, the LD classes, the only people that were participating in those were kids who looked like me and what society calls white trailer trash. And the affluent kids went to what was called AG, academically gifted. And the difference between the two was the professional opinion of the teacher placing the kids in AG and LD. Well, make a long story short, I can stand here and say I just graduated from college with a degree in psychology. And I'm now looking to go in the special education field so I can express my love of education.
And that was Nakia Hood's story that he told at one of our fellowship series, which was Whiteness and Privilege was the theme.
That's one of those feel-good stories, you know, yeah. That as a child he was labeled but overcame that label to make something out of himself.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
Big fan of Nakia. Go Nakia. Woohoo! So yeah, we have a couple of Story Slams this month, which is an unprecedented event. Today we're talking about stories that have to do with karma. That show is going to be on Wednesday, March 7th at Sugar Maple. But the next one in March is going to be held on Thursday, March 22nd at Garfield's 502. And the theme for that one is going to be a lot of fun as well. It's TMI. Also known as too much information.
Too much information, indeed. Well, today's theme of karma, mm-hmm. and this next story we have, mm-hmm. when I first saw this, was on Thursday, I just thought, what an amazing coincidence, because this story is about whether or not to tell those little white lies. And it was just the other day that the communications director at the White House resigned a day after telling Congress that she had told white lies on behalf of the White House. So, I don't know. It all seems like karma.
It really does. What a fabulous segue that happens to be karmatic. Let's listen to Gordon Leach's story, who told a story at our Risking It curated Story Slam at the South Milwaukee PAC. Here's Gordon.
So, have you ever told a white lie? You know, we've all at least heard them, right? Get you out of maybe it's a polite thing to say, or maybe get you out of a little jam. Well, a few years ago, I had a professional problem that a white lie might have gotten me out of that jam. So I'm a lawyer, and I represent people that typically have been taken advantage of by someone or some business. Basically, fraud. I do a lot of work in the area of fraud. And I had a case a few years ago where I was representing this woman. She bought a car, and she was told it was a model, the top model of the line, when in fact it was the bottom model of the line. Someone had even changed the labels on it, so she didn't know. And that was our case. It was a pretty good case. My client had done nothing wrong, did everything right. She was taken advantage of. So it was a perfect case. It's the kind of case you like taking to court, the kind of case where you can really feel, you know, you're pursuing justice. We brought the case. The other lawyer came in and was the kind of, you know, you might be surprised to learn that sometimes lawyers are jerks. Sometimes they're bullies. And this one certainly fit that bill. So anyways, we had this great case, had a difficult lawyer I was dealing with, and then I made a mistake. We like to have jury trials in these kinds of cases, and juries are important in these cases because, you know, it's the jury comes from the community, and we give the community the opportunity to decide the case. And the community learns about the case and learns about what someone in their neighborhood is doing to people in their neighborhood and people that come from other places. And generally, juries are a little more sympathetic, or at least you can, you know, the general idea is that juries can be a little more sympathetic to these situations than a judge who might have lots of cases and is just gonna kind of apply the law and move on. So as we call it plaintiffs, we're plaintiffs, we like juries. And I blew the deadline for asking for a jury trial. So that wasn't a good thing. So I thought, you know, judge is not going to be happy with me if I go in and ask for a jury trial, since I basically ignored that part of the judge's order. I basically forgot. I didn't really have a good excuse. I forgot to calendar the event, so I didn't do it on the day it was due. Realized it very soon after. But I thought, hey, you know, maybe the other side will agree. So I called the other lawyer up, you know, called the other lawyer up, talk about a little scheduling issues of witnesses, things like that. And then threw out there, you know, that, gee, I see that neither one of us had asked for the jury, but, you know, if her client was interested in the jury, I'd be agreeable to submitting a joint motion to the judge to ask for permission. And not surprisingly, she was pretty quick to say no. So with as much curiosity as I could put in my voice, I just said, well, you know, would you mind if I asked for the jury now? Which also met with a quick no. So now I had to figure out what to do. You know, so what do lawyers do? We go to the books and we research and read all these opinions and spend hours trying to figure out, all right, I'm in a pickle, how do I get out of it? And there's a standard that says if I commit excusable neglect, the judge can, you know, is actually obligated to forgive my mistake if it's excusable neglect. So after hours and hours of research, I figured it out. I didn't have an excusable neglect. I couldn't meet the standard. Frankly, I just couldn't do it. But I had found lots of other people that met the excusable neglect standard with pretty lame excuses. The common excuse was to blame someone else, you know, usually someone that worked for them. Typically, you know, you'd hear, well, my secretary forgot to put it on my calendar, right? And so I think those were white lies. And I've heard them before. And no one likes them, but they're kind of unverifiable, and lawyers get away with it sometimes. So it was tempting. You know, I could, if I came up with the same excuse, right, I wouldn't have to be embarrassed by going back to my client and saying, you know, we don't have a jury trial, sorry, and it's my fault. The other lawyer wouldn't get to kind of reaffirm her opinion of me that I'm probably, you know, the worst guy lawyer out there in the world. I would, you know, at least be able to save face somewhat with the court, too, because of excusable neglect. So it was really tempting to think about doing that. And then, you know, I also thought about what I do. And what I do is to try to, you know, pursue justice, right? And I'm suing people for lying to my client. So could I really go in and tell a lie to try to get justice? And would that really be justice after all, if I did something like that? So I decided not to, and that I was just going to have to risk going to court, and if I couldn't convince the judge to let me get the jury trial for my client, then I was going to have to live with the consequences and deal with it from there. And I just told the judge, Your Honor, I'm sorry, but I just blew your deadline. So the other side got up and made an argument, and I thought I was a criminal defendant on trial, and then it was time for the judge to make a decision. And the judge said, he thanked me for telling him straight up what happened, that it was refreshing to hear the truth like that. I thought, this is good. And then he said, and Mr. Leach, I agree with you. Now I thought, this is even better. He said, I agree, you do not have excusable neglect, and I'm not required to grant your request for relief. didn't feel so good at that moment. But, he said, I think in the interest of justice that the right to a jury trial is a fundamental right, and I have an obligation to grant any party a request for a jury trial as long as it's not going to interfere with the right of another. So your request is granted. So that was great. And, you know, it was the funny thing is it wasn't long after that that I was tempted yet again to tell another white lie. A few days later, I was at lunch with a friend, and he came in with a hideous tie. And I made the mistake of saying, new tie? To which he said, yeah, I picked it out and bought it myself. So now I felt obligated. I had to either tell a white lie. And so I thought about it for just a half a moment and said, you know, that's a really unique tie, and it really shows off your sense of fashion. So we were both smiling at that point, him because I confirmed his sense of fashion, and me because I didn't tell a white lie, and I figured out a clever evasion. Thank you.
The moon was all aglow, and heaven was in your eyes. One night that you told me those little white lies.
And that was Gordon Leach telling his Risking It story, also known as the Karma story for today's featured theme.
Is that a new sweater, Leah?
Well, yes, it is. Do you like?
It expresses your wardrobe personality, it sure does.
Oh, thanks, Bruce. Hopefully nothing karmatic will happen after that little dig on my sweater.
Well, let's remind folks about the two story slams this month before we get out of here.
Doubling up. Lucky March. Wednesday, March 7th at Sugar Maple. The next one after that is going to be on Thursday, March 22nd at Garfield's 502. The theme is TMI. And all story-related information, including our story slams, our membership, our fellowship series, and everything good, is held at xfabula.org.
And if you want to hear today's stories once again or share them with somebody else, you can find them at wuwm.com. They'll be up there all week and who knows how long after that. We do this every weekend, part of Lake Effect Weekend. Leah Delaney from X-Fabula brings us stories, and we'll be back next week.
That sounds great.
X-Fabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up our show today. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie Knorr. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Right now, it's 4 o'clock, and All Things Considered is next.